A few months ago, over the summer, we brought you several stories and perspectives on the Mississippi River. We heard from author and journalist Boyce Upholt about his book, The Great River, that traces the history of the Mississippi from its formation thousands of years ago to the human-focused waterway we know today. And we talked with writer and traveler Dean Klinkenberg, who wrote The Wild Mississippi, a state-by-state guide to the river's natural wonders. For today's show, we want to return to a different perspective on the 2,300-mile waterway. And for that conversation, here's producer Alex Hoyer.
It was one day on October 9, 1972, that Lee Hendricks set out on the Mississippi River, and it began what would become a 50-year career traversing America's rivers. Hendricks has written a memoir that spans that 50-year career. It's called Peep Light, Stories of a Mississippi River Boat Captain, and Lee Hendricks joins me now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Alex, and it's nice to talk to people in St. Louis, my birthplace.
Likewise, I want to start there, and that is, when you were growing up in St. Louis, what were your impressions or your memories of the Mississippi River?
Well, when my folks took me there the first couple times, they said, get a good eyeful, but don't ever think about going out on it, because it'll kill you. And that's if you're lucky. If you're not lucky, you'll be mired in a silty tomb for an eternity. So I was actually taught to fear it more than anything else because of its power.
Were you afraid of it?
I was sort of taken with it, curiously afraid, one might say. It looked like it could kill you very easily, but it also looked like it could be a source of adventure and excitement for you. So I was thrilled with those prospects.
You graduated from the University of Missouri, St. Louis, and it was after that graduation that you then looked to the river for a job. Can you talk about that?
Sure. I graduated from UMSL in 1971 or two. I can't actually remember, but didn't have any exciting job prospects, and I didn't really want to go. My degree had been in business, and business did not interest me all that much at that time. I wanted to have something that had some excitement to it, some swashbuckling adventure, and the river looked like a good opportunity for that. So I just I didn't really set out to be out there for 52 years, to be truthful with you. I set out to be out there maybe a month or two. I didn't have any long-term ambitions in those days.
So you decide that you want to go on this journey. It's a job. You think it's going to be a fairly short-term thing. What did your family think when you told them that this is what you're going to do?
My dad didn't want me to go. He had been in World War II on a small boat, and he said, you know, you're not going to like that. It's going to be cramped. You're not going to like the food. Your dog's not going to be there. You better not do it. My mom, she was a little bit more ambivalent, I guess, but she was very protective, and I guess she was kind of afraid of me going out, but she more or less kept it to herself. But I would say that they were pretty non-supportive, actually, to be truthful with you. But I had a half a mind to do it, so I decided I don't care what they think. I'm of age. I can do what I want to do.
And so, as we mentioned, that was in October of 1972. Your parents didn't really want you to go down, but your dad did indeed take you down to the river. What was that experience and then that first night like?
So October 9th, 1972, we hopped in his old green Chevy with the three on the tree, and we were in, we were still in U City then, and he drove me over there all the time trying to talk me out of it, and they had told me to be there at 5 o'clock. They said the boat was going to be there at 5. So we got down the Riverview Boulevard. It was called Missouri Portland Cement Dock at that time. It's different now, and I grabbed my duffel and I walked on down there, and there was a couple guys at the loading dock who were in charge of loading barges, and I told them that I was going to get on the Havana Zephyr and it was going to be there at 5 o'clock. And they chuckled and said, just sit down, relax, smoke a couple cigarettes with us. That boat ain't going to be here at no 5 o'clock. And by God, they were right. I found out a couple things. One thing I found out is the boat is always late. And you better be prepared for it being late. And you better have some conversation and some cigarettes to smoke. I was a smoker back then. So I sat down and I talked to the guys. And my dad would come back every once in a while. And he would try to talk me out of going. He was hanging out at a beer joint down the street over by the Riverview Circle. And after about three times, when it got to be about 10 o'clock that night, I just about figured that maybe he was right. Maybe I should go on home and go back to working for the U City Park Department or something. But at a little after 11 o'clock, I saw a searchlight coming up the river, and there was the Havana Zephyr. And that's when I hopped on, and I met a young guy who was about my age. We were both young, and climbed down the ladder, and he said, what part of Breckinridge County or Meade County are you from? And I looked at him, and I was flummoxed. I said, I have no, what are you talking about? And he spat on the deck and said, damn. All of the deckhands on that boat had been hired from one of those two counties in Kentucky, more or less central Kentucky, and they had been hired out of a beer joint called Dead Horse Holler. So the only thing that I can figure out is they had either had a deckhand quit or fall in the river or something, and they needed somebody really badly that night. So I happened to be local, and they called me. And he led me to my room. I would hesitate to call it a stateroom. But he didn't even knock on the door. He just burst the door open. And my roommate, who was sleeping in the top bunk, had no idea what was going on. The light on his room was suddenly on, and he jumped out of his bunk like the whole state of Kentucky state patrol was in hot pursuit, and he jumped down on the floor and cut his foot.
Oh my gosh.
And started to bleed all over the floor. But the thing that I remember most was the string of obscenities that he let out.
Oh.
As it turned out, that I was gonna go to bed. I got on the boat going off watch, which the guy, John, was the first guy who took me there, said, you know, you're really lucky. You're starting your river career out sleeping. Well, that would have been nice if I could have slept, but I didn't sleep the whole night. As a matter of fact, I didn't sleep for the first five nights because I was scared to death. Mm. I thought that the mission here was to kill Lee Hendricks.
Oh, my.
And every time we would face up to a barge or get alongside a barge, I thought the whole bulkhead of the boat was going to be destroyed and I was going to drown in my bunk the very first night.
That's Lee Hendricks, author of the new book, Keep Light, Stories of a Mississippi Riverboat Captain. We'll get back to his conversation with producer Alex Hoyer in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.
Welcome back. Let's return to producer Alex Hoyer's conversation with St. Louis native Lee Hendricks. Hendricks had a more than 50-year-long career of working on America's rivers, and he's the author of the new book, Peep Light, Stories of a Mississippi Riverboat Captain.
Let's talk more about the work of being a deckhand. What is that work like?
It's very hard and very dangerous. It's mostly a young man's game. It was all men back then. We had a lady cook, but the crew was all male. So when I say when I say men, I'm being absolutely descriptive about the way that it was. But there's always the danger of falling in the river. You picked up a lot of things, a lot of heavy jewelry. We called it jewelry. It was ratchets, wires, straps, things we had to pick up and put on our shoulders. Always the danger of falling in the river. Bumps and bruises and scrapes and a lot of tedious work like mopping decks and putting barges together. That was the main goal of the deck crew, was to wire all of these barges, these 200 by 35 foot, we had cement barges at the time, put them together in a solid phalanx of steel so the pilot or the captain could take it up and down the river. Work 6 hours on and 6 hours off, get about 4 hours of sleep at a crack is about the most you're going to get. The food wasn't too bad, but you had to clean the stove up after the cook trashed it out all day.
And I imagine the working conditions, you talk about the hours, the lack of sleep, and you're working in all manner of weather, whether that be rain, snow, hot, cold. And in the book, you also describe the smell of people that worked on the boat. You describe it as a combination of grease, sweat, sunscreen, sour corn mash, and a little torn flesh. You describe it as not pretty, but proud smells. What do you mean by that?
Well, it was a tribute to the work that you did, to the honor of being a working man, to be out there and grunting, picking up those ratchets and working together as a team, and sometimes getting dirty, sometimes getting smelly, and you would take a shower at the end of the watch. I'm not trying to say that we were smelly for 30 days, but you know, just honest working man's smell is the way I would phrase it.
Yeah. You talked a little bit about the danger of potentially falling into the river. What were some of the other dangers that were there?
Well, those lines, which, you know, people who aren't on the river would probably call a rope. We call them lines. At that time, were made out of plastic. And they were very strong, but they were explosive, one might say, not in terms of like gunpowder, but that plastic, if it broke, would fly back and it could cut your head off. It was a photo that they had at Lock 20 up at Canton, Missouri, of a pair of boots lying on the deck, and the story was that the lock line or a wire had broken and actually knocked the poor deckhand completely out of his boots, killed him, obviously. But you could have your arm taken off. You can slip between barges. You could, when you're in a lock or something of that nature, alongside of a dock, if you fell in between the barges and the lock wall, you would be squashed to death. And that had happened. I did not personally witness it, but I knew of instances where that had happened. So there were, it's a very dangerous occupation.
And when you were doing your work, I've had a chance, this is a few years ago now, but at the Melvin Price Lock and Dam up near Alton, they have a, I think the best way to describe it might be a viewing platform, and they have some benches. And I just sat and watched the deckhands take apart the barges so that they could go into the lock. Is that primarily the work that you're talking about that was particularly dangerous, or just one of the things?
One of the things. Actually, at Melvin Price Lock, which is now a 1,200-foot chamber, you don't have to break a toe apart. Used to be at Lock 26, which is a little bit upriver from the present Melvin Price Lock, we did have to do what was called a double lock. And that was fraught with peril in that you had to, number one, break the toe apart, and then they had to lock part of it through, and then they would pull it out with a cable, and you were armed only with your lock lines to stop those barges and keep them from floating down the river on their own. So The double locks were a little bit more work and a little bit more perilous than the single locks were. That Melvin Price lock came in earlier in this century when I first started. We just had the old lock 26, but not just locking, but putting the barges together, doing what was called tow work, going down through railroad bridges. Sometimes the pilot or the captain, no matter how good they were, could run aground or swipe a bridge and sparks would fly. You'd have to go out and try to corral those barges back together. It was, somebody once described it as long stanzas of boredom punctuated by choruses of complete bedlam, which is what would happen. Just when you think that nothing's going to happen, that's when the wolves would come out snarling at you.
Mm. And now that you mention it, it was perhaps a lock and dam further upriver that I had observed that, because I distinctly remember them having to separate the barges. So thank you for that clarification.
If you just went up to lock 25 at Winfield, that could have been, or maybe 24 at Clarksville, or perhaps now, you know, sometimes that big lock at Melvin Price gets broken and they have to lock through the 600-foot chamber, so they may indeed have had to make a double lock there. But normally now, the 1,200-foot chamber will accommodate the 15 barge tow.
Well, and in some respects, it brings home the point that you would have to do this often in the upper river, that there are, 26 or 27 of them?
Well, depending on how far you're going, the last lock on the river is Lock 27 at Granite City. Now, that's also a 1,200-foot chamber with a 600. But if you're going all the way to the Twin Cities, you would go all the way up through Lock 2. That would be the last lock you would go to. But it's a little more confusing because there is no Lock 23. And there is a Lock 5A, so there's still about 25 or 26 locks you have to go through to get up there.
So after a few years as a deckhand, your piloting career began in 1976. What was the evolution from deckhand to piloting like?
So when you start off as a deckhand, you're doing all the labor, and then if you're pretty good at that, or if they really need somebody, they make you a mate. And the mate is like in charge of the deck crew. And usually when you get to be a mate, you're pointing toward trying to get up into the pilot house. You won't always make it, but back in those days, if you applied yourself, you had a pretty good shot at it because they were so desperate to get more pilots back in the 1970s. And you start off with finding a pilot who wants to take a break every once in a while. And you might come up to the pilot house and just start talking to him about, I don't know, about what kind of car he's got or what he likes to do when he's home. Does he like to hunt? And then if he likes you, you can carry on a conversation. And then along the line, you're sitting here waiting, and there was no bathroom in the pilot house back then. And eventually he's going to need to go to the bathroom. And he's going to say something to the effect, do you know how to steer the boat? And I didn't, but I said, sure, I know how to steer the boat. And I sat down behind the sticks, and he went to the bathroom, and I was hoping he got his business done quick.
Oh,
because I was afraid I was going to run into something and tear the whole tow apart. But luckily he came back, and from there, if you're a pilot, and I was a pilot who got lazy sometimes because you still have those periods of boredom while you're piloting as well, and you might want to take a break and read a book or, I don't know, just walk around the pilot house, find somebody who wants to steer the boat for a while, and say, here, hold on that tree up there. See if you can keep this boat, that jackstaff out there, that peep light pointed toward that tree. And if you can keep that boat pointed toward that tree and not look like you're going to turn around in the middle of the river, they might take you under their wing and try to teach you some other things along the way, because eventually they knew that they were going to need more pilots. So that's generally the way that evolution comes about.
You started piloting and steering on both the Illinois and the Ohio rivers. What was different about that experience than your first trips when you became a deckhand on the Mississippi River?
Well, so the Illinois River is a very narrow river. It's very shallow. It's easy to run aground. Most of the time, there's not a lot of current. There's a few locks. Further up you get, there's more. They're tighter. So there's not as many locks on the Illinois as there are on the upper Mississippi. On the lower Mississippi, there are no locks. The Ohio is a good place to go to retire, which is what I should have done.
Why?
It's usually it's wide and it's usually not much current, a lot of big locks, a lot of deep water. So the Ohio, but now it can go on the warpath too, just like any of them can. But generally speaking, the Ohio is a pretty sedate river. The Illinois is fairly sedate, but like I said, very shallow. So you're going to, if you run up the Illinois River for very long, you're going to run aground. It's just going to happen. I ran aground the first night I steered the boat there.
Oh.
Broke a barge out of tow. So all the rivers have different characteristics.
Yeah, we talked about the danger of being a deckhand, and you write in the book, quote, "The unpredictable nature of the river makes accidents impossible to completely avoid." What are some of the main challenges of piloting a boat?
Well, other traffic now is the main danger. The channel's pretty stable. It's nothing at all like it was during the days of Mark Twain because of the Corps of Engineers has such a big budget and does such an immaculate or efficient job, maybe is more a better word, such an efficient job of keeping the river open during most stages of water. Bridges are dangerous, especially in high water. You can still run aground, although that doesn't happen quite as much as it did back in like the 19th century. If anybody's read Mark Twain or even well into the 20th century, there were more groundings. Even when I was a strapping young lad in the 1970s, we grounded more than you do now. It's just the efficient techniques that the Corps has found for keeping the channel open in just about any level stage of water. Now that was challenged a couple of years ago when we had the extreme low water. But generally speaking, grounding still a problem, although not as bad, but mostly the other traffic. That's the big danger and the bridges.
What kind of traffic are you talking about? Other towboats or recreational vehicles? What kind of traffic?
Well, all of the above. But big towboats obviously have a lot of mass, just like you do. So it's kind of like a couple of big semis, oversized semis on the highway. You got to watch what you're doing to get by them. They take up a lot of space. One of those big tows down on the lower Mississippi River could be 50 barges, which could be 1,200 feet of length and a couple hundred feet of width. But they're professionals, so that worries you, but the small boats sort of in effect worry you a little bit more because you don't know the unpredictability of that person behind the wheel of that small boat and the amount of alcohol or drugs they may have been experiencing that particular day or just their lack of knowledge about what's going on. So when you get above St. Louis all the way up to where I live up here in Minnesota, that can be a big problem, those small boats.
Yeah, you don't really see too much recreational boat traffic around St. Louis, or at least I don't.
Not in St. Louis Harbor. When you get up above Alton, up in Alton Lake.
Yeah, and the Grafton area.
Like in the summertime, yeah, around Grafton, you'll see quite a bit. Mm-hmm. But that's just the start. It gets really more more proliferate the further up that you go.
So you talked about other traffic being a danger. Also, bridges. And I actually have a bone to pick with you, Mr. Hendricks.
Go ahead.
You write, quote, "One of the more infamous and despicable bridges on the upper Mississippi is the Eads Bridge in St. Louis. Even as historically significant as it is, most river pilots would pay a fair sum to purchase a raffle ticket for the opportunity to detonate it into the land of oblivion." Now, Mr. Hendricks, I realize that you are riding with some hyperbole here, but explain your misgivings with the Eads Bridge on this year, 2024, which happens to be the 150th anniversary of this iconic landmark.
Touche. So the Eads Bridge is a remarkable feat of engineering. There's no doubt at all about that. Now, if you read, and I'm sure you did, that whole story at the end, I said that was all of that. A lot of that was tongue in cheek. Obviously, right. Nobody wants a bridge to collapse, but it's just it's scary. Those arches, and if you have a chance, sometime go to YouTube and look at the video of a towboat getting the pilot house taken off by the Eads Bridge. And that's what can happen, especially in high water. Those arches can come right up into your pilot house with you, so that if you get out of shape, you can actually get your barges down through the bridge, but it's gonna give you an apoplectic haircut from the third deck on up. And luckily, the pilot in that boat was not killed. But when you're coming down on that, especially even northbound, there was a boat, I'm not going to call the name of the boat, back in the 1990s going up through the Eads Bridge that got out of shape, hit it, and the barges broke loose. And actually, the admiral at that time was sitting below the Eads Bridge and actually broke the wires on the admiral. And amazingly, the admiral did not break loose and go down through St. Louis Harbor on its own with all those gamblers on board. That would have been a tragedy of monumental stature had that happened. So the Eads Bridge, as wonderful as it is, and I do know a little bit about the construction of it. James Eads was what fantastic river person, but most pilots, especially in high water, don't like to make it. Now in low water, you've got plenty of room to clear that bridge, but not many pilots like the Eads Bridge.
That's St. Louis native Lee Hendricks, a longtime riverboat captain and the author of a new book about his career called Peep Light. We'll get back to his conversation with producer Alex Hoyer in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio.
If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.
Welcome back. Let's return to producer Alex Hoyer's conversation with Lee Hendricks. They're talking about Lee's five-decade-long career working on America's rivers, and his new book, Peep Light, Stories of a Mississippi Riverboat Captain.
Lee, after about 12 years of working on the river in the 1980s, you took a break. What did you do, and why did you take a break?
Well, as much as I loved what I was doing, first of all, the first night I went there to get on that boat, it was at the dock, and I was talking to those dockmen there on Riverview Boulevard. One of them got right to the point and said, "Hey man, you got a girl?" And I said, "Yeah." I kind of shook my head because I kind of did. And he said, "Well, she ain't going to be waiting for you no 30 days. You ain't going to have a girl when you get back." And that was one of the more prophetic things he said, because no, she wasn't waiting for me when I got back. And, you know, I was in my 20s, and it was kind of heartbreaking, but wasn't that It was diminishing, but it wasn't heartbreaking. Let's put it that way. Or not heartbreaking for long. But after you go through a few of those, and then seeing some of the divorces that I had seen out on the river from the separation and the loneliness that rivermen have got to endure, I just wanted to try something else. And fortunately, I guess I was not married and didn't have children, so I only had to worry about supporting myself. And I had always had a mind that I wanted to go take a trip to Europe. And business was real bad back then, so the wages had gone down. And I said, you know what? So the universe is trying to tell me that it's time to do this. And I went over to Europe and I got involved. I was traveling around with a backpack on my back and got a job. And Berchtesgaden was West Germany at the time, working at an outdoor education center. And that was kind of cool. We'd do things like backpacking and rock climbing and kayaking. And I said, you know what, this might not be too bad a thing to do for a few years. And I stayed there for a year or so and came back to St. Louis. And there was an event called the Mississippi River Youth Expedition. And there was a man named Hank Schaefermeyer, who was one of the ramrods of it. And they were looking for people who liked spending time outdoors, but also had a little bit of knowledge about the river, which I had quite a bit of knowledge about the river. So he was in shock. He said, you mean there's a riverboat pilot who's had outdoor education experience? We need to probably get hold of this guy. And I was on that expedition, and then luckily, fortune would have it, he needed an assistant teacher to work the program. I said, cool, man, I'm down with it. You know, I'll try it for a couple of years. And in that period of time, I met my wife. I was lucky enough to meet her. We were living in St. Louis, and we had our son, and I worked for the Student Leadership Environmental Adventure Program for, I guess it was about 6 years, 5 or 6 years, something like that. And then I also worked summers with the North Carolina Outward Bound School.
What was rewarding about your work with young people?
Well, just getting them out into the outdoors and having them, it was a desegregation program. And of course, having grown up in St. Louis, I remember the racial disharmony, I would say, that the city has gone through and may still be going through, for that matter.
I would say that's a safe bet.
Yeah, so I wasn't going to change all that. You know, I was realistic enough to know that just Lee Hendricks wasn't going to erase all that history. But I could do my part. I could make a little ripple and get teams together, team building. They could accomplish missions together and learn more about each other. And just getting kids out in the outdoors and solving problems and experiencing the beauty of the surroundings around them. Then later, a friend of mine and I, Tom Ball, we did some river cleanups also. And that was quite satisfying. So it's generally a very satisfying, close to a decade that I spent doing that. Very challenging in a lot of ways as well.
And then in 1995, you began working for the Delta Queen Steamboat Company. What did it take to get that job?
Well, I actually had to, I actually had gone back to the river earlier. I'd worked on a couple of casino boats, and then I worked on like the Tom Sawyer and the Huck Finn down there, which are still there downtown. But
let's stop there. What was that work like on the Tom Sawyer and the Huck Finn?
Well, it was fun. You know, you'd take smaller boats, take folks out for a boat ride, blow the whistles, give them a little tour downtown St. Louis. But I always kind of had in my mind that I would get on one of the gambling boats because they were bigger. They had a boat there called the Belle of St. Louis. I don't know if you remember that one mm-hmm. or not. But I worked on that. I had my eye on the casinos because you could make more money. I was a daddy by that time, and teaching didn't pay a lot of money. But I kind of wanted to get back out on the river. I still have good friends down there we called it Gateway River Boat Cruises back then. But that was good. And then I went up to Davenport, Iowa, worked on the President up there. I don't know if you remember that one. That was a gambling casino. And then there was another gambling casino in Joliet, Illinois, called the Empress. And a friend of mine, I didn't take to the gambling gig real well. Didn't have any problems, but most of the people on there weren't on there to look at the river. They were on there to gamble, and it paid pretty well. But a friend of mine and I, but I could see, I haven't been clairvoyant many times in my life, but I could see that wasn't going to last real long, because I thought, you know, they're going to want to put these, it's dangerous being out here on these, it's dangerous being on any riverboat, and then we're going to take all these gamblers out here who don't really want to be out here anyway, and put them in harm's way. Eventually, these casinos are going to go dockside or even inland, which they've done. But a friend of mine and I worked for a friend of mine who I had known before worked for the Delta Queen Steamboat Company, and he said, I think you can become a pilot over here, son, but you got to get pilot license. So I had to actually sit down and draw the Mississippi River from memory, from New Orleans up to St. Paul, and then the Ohio from Cincinnati to Pittsburgh. And I wound up drawing 2,300 miles of the river to get the license that I needed.
What's the purpose of having to know and memorize how to draw 2,300 miles of the river?
Well, back then we didn't have electronic charts, and they wanted, and if you were going to be in charge of the safety of hundreds of people, they wanted to make sure that you knew that the river. It was kind of archaic, the license structure, but it was still what was in place at the time. So you had to draw the bridges with their horizontal and vertical distances, their put the buoys in, the sandbars, the navigation lights, the pipelines, the overhead crossings, all that kind of stuff. They really wanted to make sure that you knew the river if you were going to be out there at night with several hundred people on your boat. Now, the electronic charts, you don't really need that, and it's not needed anymore. The only place that you need that license is from Baton Rouge on down.
What were those gigs like? Where did you sail?
Well, my very first trip for them was a three-day trip up to Hannibal and back. And then, because I actually had license on the upper Mississippi, which a lot of the older guys didn't, they didn't want to go up the upper.
And this was St. Louis to Hannibal and back.
St. Louis to Hannibal and back, right. It was a three-day trip. But then, I don't know, we'd go from, the way they did the trips back then, they broke them up into segments. So you'd do like St. Louis up to St. Paul, and then you'd do St. Paul to St. Louis, and then when you got to St. Louis, you'd either go back up to St. Paul, and these are all week-long trips, or you would do St. Louis to Memphis, which was not a real popular one, but they would do that just to position it in Memphis so that you could do then a Memphis to New Orleans. And then sometimes we just did New Orleans round trips, did those a lot in the wintertime. And then we would go up to Cincinnati and Pittsburgh, and we started going up the Tennessee River. We went up to Chattanooga a few times, and we'd go up the Cumberland to Nashville. But those, you know, the main bread and butter was the Mississippi River.
Yeah, and I think about those boats, like the American Queen, 420 feet long, 95 feet wide. It is an impressive looking boat, and it's just different than what a towboat is. Did you get different reactions when you were on the different kinds of boats?
You mean different reactions from the way they handled?
Well, that's a good question too. But I'm thinking of people on the shoreline, or were there not many people looking at what you were doing generally?
Yeah, nobody's waving at you on the towboats very much. They might be giving you the middle finger, but they're not waving at you. But yeah, you know, people on the bank really like this. I remember the first time we went up to St. Paul, it was like, I don't know. I felt like I had been transported back in time. We would go through locks and there would be literally hundreds of people out there to see us, to watch us go through, because it was such a, and still is, I mean, it's really tragic that it's not cruising anymore, but it was, I mean, you've seen the American Queen.
Sure.
Have you ever been on it?
No, not on that one.
It's, I don't know, it's very hard to have a word to describe it. Charm and
it's grand.
Gothic and grandiose, magnificence, power, it's all there.
I'm talking with Lee Hendricks, a St. Louis native and the author of the new book, Peep Light, Stories of a Mississippi River Boat Captain. You also worked for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers for, I think it was about 9 years. What did you do for them?
So I started as an assistant captain, which I piloted, basically, but I was just in charge of piloting, more or less, although when the captain wanted some time off, I would fill in for him. And then I started there in 2009, and in 2014, he left and left the captain's job open, and lo and behold, they gave it to me. So I was the captain of the motor vessel Mississippi from 2014 till 2018. And then I don't know what got into me, but I was pretty sure I was going to retire fairly soon. And I went from the biggest towboat probably in the history of the world to, I wanted to go back to my roots and do some dredging and work on a really small boat that was about 40 feet long. And I came up to St. Paul District and worked here on the dredge Getz for my last few months. I didn't last very long just because physically I couldn't do it anymore. It was different. You didn't sit up in the pilot house. You actually had to get out there and walk around on those pipelines and that kind of thing. And I wasn't very good at it, and I was frustrating some of the crew up here. So that's when I decided to hang it up and go back to doing trip work on towboats. I worked on the ship called the Rocket Ship, which took NASA rockets from Decatur, Alabama I would ride it down to Baton Rouge. They would actually go over to Cape Canaveral. And then I went back on the American Queen and did a little bit for them. But
and that was recently.
That was recently, yeah. I actually didn't work as a pilot much last year. I worked with what called the River Lorien, which is something I always wanted to kind of do. It didn't pay nearly as much, but you slept a lot better.
And that's like a river historian or a storyteller?
Right. That's exactly what it is. Yeah. Took river historian and river lore and storyteller and prevaricator and put it all together. And that was me, the River Lorien.
So it sounds like maybe you haven't retired, or have you officially now retired?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know if what's official.
Right.
If the American Queen's not cruising anymore. As a matter of fact,
why
may
not?
Never cruise. Well, you know, politically, I better stay away from that. The company went out of business at the end of last year, American Queen Voyages. And they went into bankruptcy, and American Cruise Lines, which was one of the competitors, actually bought the boat, and they're deciding what to do with it. But it has not been, it's not cruised since, I think, about January 5th.
Yeah, I was just on their website in the last couple of days, and they have a sign up for when to be notified when they do set their next cruising and such. And just within the last couple of years, Viking Cruises, for example, started to cruise on the Mississippi River too.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. They did. So whereas when I worked on that boat at first in the 1990s, there was just three of us and we were all owned by the same company. And now, of course, American Cruise Lines has five or six of their own boats, and then the Viking boat is out there. So there's definitely more competition. And I think I've read where the American Countess and the American Duchess are going to be cut up for scrap. And I hope that doesn't happen to the Queen, but it's not like anybody's going to ask me what my opinion is.
Right. You write a little bit in the book about Mark Twain, and it's hard to write about the Mississippi River and not at least mention him, but he published a book in 1883 called Life on the Mississippi, and that always had a very romantic view of the river, and for sure I can understand that, but there are also some things that are likely not very romantic about being stuck on a boat for 30 days at a time. How do you remember, or what are the memories that you hold most fond of the river? Do you hold that romantic view or something else or all of the above?
Well, the first time I went out there was a certain romance to it, you know, or else I wouldn't have done it. It was a mystery, the mystery below, they like to call it. So there was that when I first started, but then once you get into the rhythm of it, you find out that there might still be 5% romance, but 95% of it is just hard work and hard riding, hard life. And you still enjoy those times when you can sit out on a timberhead and look at a sunset or look at a sunrise or go through a town and wondering what the people are doing there and wondering if they're jealous of you for being out on that boat. You got that a lot more as a river Lorian, let me tell you. A lot more time to just sit back and relax and in a rocking chair and look at the river and talk to people and tell stories. So I really was able to experience that romance a lot more last year, even though I was sleeping in some pretty cramped quarters. When you're the river Lorian, you don't get as nice a room as the pilot got. But now that I look back on it, you know, those trying times, I look back and there was always a certain romance to it. I sometimes wish I was still, I really wish I could go back to being a deckhand more than a pilot.
Really?
I was a
Why?
Good, I, well, physically you moved around a lot more and I was healthier then. I was 25 years old. Life was just more fun when you're 25. You get up into the pilot house and you become immobile. Older, you age a little bit more rapidly, I think, because there's a lot of stress being a pilot and the hard hours, 6 hours on, 6 hours off. About most sleep you could ever imagine getting is maybe 4.5 hours at a time. You can do that when you're a deckhand because, in truth, if it's 3 o'clock in the morning and there's nothing going on, you can take a little nap so you can catch up on. You can't do that up in the pilot house. You can't take a little nap at 3 o'clock in the morning. So I just felt like I was a lot healthier and more virile back then. You know, life was larger back then. Let's put it that way.
Lee Hendricks is a St. Louis native and the author of the new book, Peep Light, Stories of a Mississippi Riverboat Captain. He lives with his wife, cat, and dog in Minnesota in a small community along the Mississippi River. he spoke with producer Alex Hoyer over the summer.
Today's episode was produced by our executive producer, Alex Hoyer.
Audio engineering and podcast design by Aaron Dorr.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri-St. Louis.